Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Elena Lezig.
On the show this week, 10 films in and Jigsaw still has tricks up his sleeve in Saw X. It's battles of humans versus AI in The Creator, and I spoke to its director, Gareth Edwards. And on Film Club, we revisited the room where it all began in 2004's Saw. We also have Little White Lies editor David Jenkins talking to us about all the latest from San Sebastian's Festival. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. God, it feels after, well, it doesn't feel like it has been months and months and months of us like lamenting how this like strike is going to never end. And it's also terrible for everyone. And like, it's so weird in a way to have good news. It's over. I mean, SAG is still striking, but the WGA strike is over.
Half over. Yeah. One more battle to fight and then back to relative normalcy for everyone. It's good news. Yeah, they got a good deal. I'm very happy for the writers and proof that unions are powerful and striking works, which I feel like in the UK everyone needs a reminder of because we've forgotten the power of the labour force.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because when it was announced that the strike was ending, all I saw was like, the strike is over. And I didn't see like anyone being like, we got what we wanted. I just saw the strike is over. We can go back to work. You know, it wasn't like, I was kind of worried. I was like, okay, well, the strike's over, but like, did we get what we wanted? Is this a good thing? And then turns out apparently it is. You were saying, Leila, that apparently, I haven't had time yet to read through what they got accepted, but apparently it is excellent. And they got all their demands met.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think there's always that thing with negotiations of like you ask for a bit more, but you know what you'd actually accept. So I think some things it does look like they've taken a step down on slightly, but they're actually, I think for the most part, those were like negotiation tactics. Yeah, what I'm seeing is that people are absolutely thrilled with the deals that they got, like minimums in writer's room. I think at one point they were asking for 8 and they maybe got 5. The residual stuff was great. Lots of like second step things, because that was a real problem for a time where they would just cycle in newbies, pay them minimums, and there would be nowhere to like progress to once you actually got success as a writer. So yeah, great news.
Very cool.
Wow. I mean, yeah, so fingers crossed, the actors will get the same and we don't have to entirely rely on AI-driven images for
Martin Scorsese doing press for this movie, that poor, the poor man. It's all on him. Not that Robert De Niro is the most talkative press presence in the world, but it has been funny watching this lovely Marty do all these press rounds on his own. I feel like he must have a lot of energy in him, because God, if I was getting asked like every 2 days about my feelings about Marvel movies, I would not be as kind of courteous and responsive as he seems to be.
I honestly, I vote that we strike until, and our terms are simply that nobody's allowed to ask a question anymore. It's ridiculous. You have one of the most important filmmakers that's ever lived, who's got decades of work ahead of him, making great stuff still, and you're asking him about Marvel again, just to get a clickbaity headline. Oh, drives me crazy. But anyway, some nice stuff. I mean, I almost had to mute Martin Scorsese on my social media, and it didn't quite come to that. But at least so I was able to like get the good news of the strike ending at least. Yeah, and some other good news that is worth announcing. I think we briefly mentioned it last week, but we're doing a live podcast at the BFI London Film Festival. So yeah, on Friday, the 6th of October at 5 o'clock, if you head down to Gallery at OXO, which is by the Sea Containers, you will be able to come and watch us talk about some of the great movies at the LFF, and also we have some very exciting guests and interviewers which are going to be happening live, and it should be really good fun. So hope many of you are able to pop down and hang out with us.
And it's free.
Yes, it is also free.
Fergus should definitely mention that. And it's, I think it's about 30 people capacity. So, you know, arrive on time to secure a seat. But yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be, we've done live podcasts before. It's always a nice time. Always a bit lively, a bit different. Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah, everyone come heckle Hannah. It'd be great.
I can take it. It's fine.
But yeah, we should, speaking of things that people can take, sorry, that is such a bad segue, but like, I couldn't help but try and link
that. I think it's quite good.
Okay, speaking of all that humans can endure under the right circumstances, we should move on to our first movie. It's Saw X. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Weeks after the events of the original Saw, John Kramer travels to Mexico after learning of a potential miracle cure for his terminal cancer. There he finds new purpose, and the infamous serial killer lives, live vivisects, and loves on his trip abroad. So, Elena, 10 movies in, how has your relationship with Saw been? Have you been a fan of them generally? Have you felt that they dropped off? Have you loved every single one or hated them?
So my relationship with the Saw franchise is very particular because I can't say I'm necessarily a fan, but I've kind of, in the same way that so many of the people that John Kramer gives a chance rediscovering the value of life, I have been in a way forced to watch these films a lot, and I've learned to love them. Basically, me, my boyfriend and our friends, we have this tradition of watching two Saw films every Christmas Day. So I've seen most of them at least twice, some of them three times. And that might sound like it would be boring, but it really isn't, because one of the things about the Saw franchise that I feel like isn't really that well known by, you know, by people who are like, oh yeah, Saw is the guy who, like, you know, the traps and all that, is that it's extremely complicated, the sort of like narrative and the characters. And several times in the franchise you watch something and you think it's happening at a certain time, but it's actually happening before the events of another film that you're supposed to remember, and there are characters that look exactly the same, and just the whole like chronology of it is so complicated. And then also the whole fact that some people seem to be victims, but actually they turn out to be in on it, and like, it's just such a complicated franchise. So watching them every time is like every time you learn something new, every time you remember something new. And yeah, so I have a sort of fondness for them. And I think it's those films that are responsible for me no longer being squeamish at all at horror movies. Like the extreme of the horror, like the extremeness of the horror now just makes me laugh. And it used to be like, I guess the intended reaction, which was like hiding from the screen and like feeling terrible and, you know, protecting whichever part of the body that I was seeing destroyed on screen. And now they just really, really make me laugh. So yeah, that's the long and short of it. That's my relationship with Saw.
Yeah, I do sometimes find myself watching the later Saws and thinking, like, I bet they really regret that they established that he only had a few months to live. Like, if they'd given him 2 years, they could have just really had quite a much more straightforward way of, like, keeping these movies going.
Absolutely.
They painted themselves into a corner, really. Because, like, after Saw 2, and, well, I mean, he dies in at the end of Saw 3, is it?
I have no idea.
I've literally just watched, like, the first six again, and already the details of the plot have kind of, like, gone out of my head.
They all blend into each other. It's crazy.
They do. You do forget when things happen. Like, Elena, that's kind of, like, why I like rewatching them, because I just forget what happens. And I'm surprised again. It's quite rare as a film watcher to rewatch something and be like, oh yeah, I forgot about that.
This one's a sequel, this one's a prequel. I mean, the inventive thing of just having some of them happening simultaneously, I think it's really quite clever.
So
yeah,
good.
Yeah, and the kind of retconning of Spiral, the Chris Rock penned spin-off that it kind of took place in the Saw universe but wasn't connected to Saw in any way.
From the page, the book of Saw. From the book of Saw.
A spiral from the book of Saw. Yeah, like the book of Henry. That they kind of just ignore that film existing in this one, which I guess makes sense because this is set way before that one. I feel like you need like a kind of cork board with like string attached to it to like understand who everyone is, how they're involved. But the main people you need to know are Jigsaw and Amanda, his apprentice, who has a consistently terrible haircut in every single film and is progressively throughout the franchise kind of becomes more unhinged. In this one, it's actually quite nice because she seems more rational by comparison. And I felt that Shawnee Smith kind of like, it was nice to see her get like an actually kind of character beyond kind of, oh yeah, she's Jigsaw's deranged sidekick. It was like, oh, she's actually got some kind of moral conflict in this film about what she's doing, particularly because one of the other characters in the film, victims, shall we say, is a drug addict. And Amanda kind of feels some sympathy because she was also a drug addict, which is why Jigsaw targeted her in the first place. So I kind of like, they do try and do some, you know, kind of world building here, which I enjoyed. But I was also laughing a lot during this film. The kind of, it's like Looney Tunes levels of violence. It's just so ridiculous. There's no kind of, oh my God, it looks so real. You're just kind of like, what had to go wrong with you as a person to think of this? To think of like, what if we attach vacuums to someone's eyes? Like, it's just, it's just so silly. You kind of, I can't help but like laugh and have a really good time with it.
I think it's funny on purpose, though.
Yeah, exactly. I think the film is on that level because, you know, you have these moments when John Kramer is just sitting around, you know, whatever, and then he's on his notepad, he's actually designing the most disgusting looking traps, you know, but he's just some old man, you know, sitting outside. So I think it's like, yeah, as you were saying, Leila, I think it's like intentionally kind of funny and playing with the sort of extreme between this old man and then the horrible things he's like conjuring. So yeah, it's kind of nice because it feels like it's in on the joke in a way, which is lovely.
In on the joke, but not in a kind of, you know, something like Deadpool where it gets like so self-referential, you're just kind of like, oh my God, this film is so pleased with itself. And so like, haha, look how cool I am. I'm like nudging the audience. And I actually think that Saw X manages to strike a balance between like having a sense of humor and acknowledging the kind of ridiculousness of its premise, but not going too far where it becomes like this entirely self-referential thing. There are some very like funny, if you know, you know, moments where like John Kramer is asked like, oh, do you know, kind of, what, tell me about yourself. Like, what do you do? And he's like, well, I've been an architect and a civil engineer for many years. And now I have some hobbies. And we're all just like, we know what those hobbies are. And yeah, as Elena mentioned, the wonderful scene where he's just like sitting on a park bench, it's really like lovely like sunlight, and it pans down and he's just like designing like this horrific like bear trap. He's just kind of like, Jigsaw is one of the kind of great horror villains because he really is just like Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger or even Hannibal Lecter. It's kind of like there's no like interiority there. He's just an insane man who wants to do like really messed up things to people, and you know, his internal logic, you can't follow it because it doesn't make any sense. Like, he's like, oh, I'm teaching people the value of life, I don't kill anyone. It's like, but you do that, Jigsaw.
Yeah, and like, who's gonna teach you the value of life, Jigsaw? It's like, this doesn't seem like a very good way to be spending your final months.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, he's like given months to live and he's just like, well, better get killing. Like, and even like this one, because it's like in the trailer we learned that the whole premise is that he is scammed by this group of nefarious medical con men and women. And one of the funny things in the film is that this idea that he was scammed by this group of medical con men and women, and he somehow has time to set up this very elaborate trap factory. I don't know like how long this takes him, how he has time to build all this whilst like very sick, like clearly dying of cancer, and like lure everyone back and like kidnap everyone. I was just like kind of like, this guy's time management is like off the scale. Like, he's so efficient, and that more than anything I was impressed by his work ethic. Like, you know, can't be faulted.
Maybe that's why he needed, you know, if he has a project then he like gets his energy up and he's like, yeah, you know, he needs someone to do something horrible to him or that he sees, and he's like, getting his energy. He's like, yes, I can do something about this. I'm going to do a truck. You know, that's his little project, you know? He's like an old man. He needs a little project to keep going, you know? But it's interesting what you were saying about how, like, his logic doesn't add up and he can't follow through, because I actually think this film, and I'm not going to reveal too much because it's, like, the best thing about the movie, I think. There is a point where he is sort of kind of, something happens and he's confronting, like, the danger of his traps in a way that I've never seen before, where it's like you're actually out. I was proper like, what the fuck? Like, this is so horrible. Like, what's going on? And even him and Amanda are like freaking out. They're like, what's going on? Like, no, this is not the plan. This is not what we intended. And I thought that was such a nice touch. I think the film does so many things like this that are like very much keeping with the rules. And I know like the rules of Saw are very important to Saw fans, obviously, as they should be. But at the same time, like really stretching them and showing like the finding challenges for all of them in a really fun and dramatic way, like a movie, like a proper movie. You know, it's not, you're not just sitting there being like, oh yeah, what's the trap? Are we going to make it? Yeah. Yes, there is that. But there's also like a lot of stuff of like, oh, should we do this? Like, does this person deserve this test? But also, what does this mean for this and this? And what if something unexpected happens? Like, in a way that I've not really seen in the other films. So in a way, like, even though the film is such a kind of a throwback to the earlier Saw films, like even in the look of it and, you know, the presence of John Kramer, at the same time, for me, it felt like a step forward in terms of like, they take it seriously and they actually make a really suspenseful and dramatic film out of it, almost in like an old-fashioned movie way. Like they actually, although they have this like crazy basis where they could just make a film where it's like just traps and people, horrible people being killed, it's actually much more than that. And yeah, I was so pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, this feels like a really smart direction for this franchise to kind of pivot in. It felt when I was watching God, Spiral from the Book of Saw, that title is even just painful to say, like that it was made by people that had no idea what actually worked about the first ones. And with this, I mean, they understand that we've spent so long with this guy. It's been 19 years since the first one. We just have a level of affection to him. And part of that comes down to that he's extremely good at his job, and that's difficult to not admire. So, you know, now that we're coming into it, it's not going to be like doing the original Saw. We have a level of like love for this character. We are kind of rooting for him. And so it makes sense to kind of lean into the comedy of it all rather than kind of have it be this like really horrible, relentlessly grim confrontation.
Also, there's this idea that this is set between Saw and Saw 2. So Jigsaw's not like, he's killed some people, obviously, but like there's this kind of like, I guess, rudimentariness to like some of the traps. Like he's kind of just figuring it out a bit. And like Amanda obviously is not quite on the proper level of being an apprentice. So they're having to actually do something quite difficult, which is like put the film in the context of like what comes after it. And I actually was surprised at how seriously they took it, because this franchise sometimes has felt a little hokey, shall we say. I think actually the director Kevin Grutert, who has been at the heart of the franchise for a very long time, he edited I think all of the other Saw films, or apart from Spiral maybe, he's definitely been involved in pretty much every single Saw film. I think it's very clear like the kind of affection and care and knowledge he has of the franchise has really enabled him to like give this entry some proper like heft and weight. And it didn't just feel like 2 hours of torture porn. It actually, I think, is less violent than some of the entries in the franchise. And yeah, I was just kind of impressed between like the balance of like actual story and the kind of silly traps that we all kind of know and love. Though I will say, like, my one kind of issue with the film is that the last back half of the traps are not that exciting. There's some really good ones and some very weak ones. It isn't like, I just was kind of hoping for a little bit more innovation in that respect. But you know, I'll take it in the kind of context of like what I think is a very, very fun entry into the franchise otherwise.
Yeah, I was cautiously optimistic when it was announced that it was going to be Kevin Grutert, because I ride hard for Saw 6. It's really good. Jigsaw takes on medical insurance as an industry.
Oh, that one is good, so great.
Yeah, no, there's been he did also do Saw 3D, which I would say
aside from Spiral from the Book of Saw, I just can't say it, it's painful. Aside from Spiral from the Book of Saw, it's probably like the nadir of the franchise for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually like interesting because one of the best traps in this film, I think, is kind of a throwback to something that happens in Saw 3D with like the brazen bull. And they kind of like, they don't revisit it because technically this would be before the events of Saw 3D. But yeah, I thought that was kind of a nice touch. Though I do wonder about the culture appropriation element of like Jigsaw going to Mexico and been like, interesting things going on in Mexico. How can I incorporate this into my traps? Like, that's a bit like Jigsaw.
And I know, they do that, surprised by that.
They do that thing where, you know, when someone goes to a foreign country in a film and they just slap on a yellow filter so you can tell it's really like, they do that as well. I was like, oh my God, I can't tell if they're doing that as like a funny kind of like throwback to the way like colour is used in the other Saw films, or if it's just like, you know, something they haven't quite clocked is quite a pervasive trope in filmmaking. But yeah, I mean, I just think it's a really, if you're into this kind of film, it's a one of the kind of better examples. And Tobin Bell is just such a great screen presence. I love watching him. I find him so compelling as an actor. And this character now, like John Kramer, I think is one of the kind of all-time greats in horror. I think he's so dry and funny and needlessly cruel.
But also I'm rooting for him.
Also, yeah,
people keep saying to him, good luck, and I'm like, yeah, good luck.
Good luck, John. Like, yeah, I hope you do beat cancer. I know you won't. I know exactly how this is gonna go. But yeah, even with that, even knowing how things go, like having the knowledge of the Saw franchise, it's kind of like, but what if he does beat cancer and go on to like have many, many more years of needless violence against people he deems morally suspect in some way.
Well, we can always make more prequels or whatever that are set. I guess this is supposed to be what, like a few weeks after the first Saw, so they could do it, I don't know, a few weeks before this one and after the first Saw. Like, they could just add more films between Saw 1 and 2 forever. You know, that's fine. That's fine by me. I don't mind.
Yeah, I got the impression that like a couple of months pass during this, so we could have some simultaneous
plenty
adventures.
Of time. That's plenty of time for him to make many more traps that we haven't seen yet.
He's very prolific. If anything, like the, you know, what he can do in a very short space of time is impressive. So, and I would love to like have some of the old characters come back. I really enjoyed, there's a little cameo, I'm not going to spoil it, in the mid-credits scene, which I was waiting the whole film for, because there was a phone call very early on and I was like, oh, I know who he's talking to on the phone. And when he popped up, I was really excited. So I would be super happy if we got some more mid-installments, because also I want to see more Tobin Bell. That's the thing. That's the problem. Like, I don't want to have a Saw film set after his death anymore, because he's like the heart of the franchise. And there are some loose ends in this film that kind of imply they might be like setting up, I don't know, what would it be now? Like Saw 2.5 or something? Like, we're getting into like Lion King, like 3.5 territory at this point. It's just kind of like, okay, like how can we squeeze another one in? But I'm down for it now. I'm like fully back on board. Like, no more Chris Rock's spin-offs. Let's just keep it simple, squeeze some more stuff into the franchise.
One thing they could do if they're really struggling with like how to bring Tobin Bell back, they could just fucking do Multiverse, like everybody else is doing it. Just do so Multiverse and be like, there's a reality where he, you know, lives and doesn't have, like, and just, you know, I think no one would mind, honestly. We've suffered through such complicated plots that we wouldn't mind a multiverse. So maybe he does a trap that just opens.
I believe if he put his mind to it, he could invent that machine in a fortnight.
Absolutely.
That is how.
Exactly. This is like, if someone can do it, it's John Kramer, you know.
Just do the bit, you know, the bit in Star Wars where Oscar Isaac's character is like captioned saying, somehow Palpatine returned. Just be like, somehow Jigsaw returned. Don't worry about it too much. Like, just kind of go with it, which is what you have to do with the franchise anyway. Just don't think too hard. You can think a little bit, but not like too hard, and just have a good time.
Oh, I could talk about this all day with you guys. I just had so much fun. I mean, it did remind me of my, the most infuriating thing on the franchise for me, which is like, if you set up somebody with terminal cancer, that's how they have to die. And it really bugs me that that is not actually how Jigsaw goes out. But
that's not this film's fault.
You got to take that up with like Saw 3 or 4. I can't remember which one he actually dies in, but like that did annoy me at the time. Now I've kind of made my peace with it because it is like quite funny. Like he's literally minutes away from dying anyway. And the guy just like walks in with a
at all times. He's minutes away. Yeah. Open level really plays him on the edge. So Elena, do you want to go first with your in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I guess anticipation, I would say 4, because I was very excited to see John Kramer again. And I know people don't really like Spiral, but for me, I had kind of a good time with it, even though it was such a different film from everything else. I was kind of like enjoying how sort of innovative it was, and I kind of liked the idea of it more than the actual film. I think I was expecting something way more like, you know, trying way more fun things and stuff, and like basically a film that was inspired by the spirit of Saw but had nothing to do with Saw. And in the end it was kind of a bit disappointing, but I was up for it, and I was up for this film in the same way. So 4. And then enjoyment, I would say like, yeah, the same 4, and retrospect 4 as well, because it's still, I think, maybe it's not like the absolute best, but it's so good. And as I mean, we've been talking about it for like half an hour, so it's a pretty solid film. And there's loads of fun stuff and loads of like, it's quite intelligent as well. At the same time, it doesn't look down on its audience. And yeah, and it's very exciting for what it suggests that they might do if they do more of them. So yeah, I'm a fan.
Oh, Hannah, what about you? Continuing as a sore head. We've had some troubled years, but like now you feel energized by this one.
Yeah, I was convinced like this would be good, at least. Just because I think like Tobin Bell coming back was a real like, okay, I think he actually cares about the franchise and like wants to, you know, give Jigsaw a kind of worthy, you know, storyline. So that kind of, yeah, I was excited for that. So 4 in anticipation, 4 in enjoyment. I had a great time. I mean, I was laughing. I was really enjoying myself. I do think it's maybe there's a lot of periods of kind of downtime in this film, and that there maybe aren't in the other films. But overall, yeah, great experience. And I think that's a 4 in retrospect. I had a really good time with it. I'm excited to see it again. Yeah, welcome back, Saw. That's kind of my take on it. I hope they do make another one after this.
I do too. I think so long as Tobin Bell is up for it, I'd be first in line to see the next one. Yeah, in anticipation for me, probably a 2, because even though I love the franchise and I take a lot of pleasure even from its like lesser entries, Spiral from the Book of Saw, really, I really hated it so much. But also for a moment, I thought maybe it was doing that thing of Halloween where it's just like, ignore every other sequel. This is just going to be the next one, which kind of felt a bit contemptuous of everything that came before. So very pleased to say that it didn't do that. 5 of enjoyment. It's not perfect, but I had just like such a whale of the time. And yeah, maybe like a 3.9 in retrospect. Really, really fun time at the movies. And just like, what a lovely surprise. Next up, it's David Jenkins talking to us about all of the hottest titles happening at San Sebastian.
Well, hey there, you movie truther types. I am here over in San Sebastian in northern Spain, in the Basque Country, celebrating the San Sebastian Film Festival. This is my first time attending this amazing festival, set against the backdrop of one of the most incredible cities I've ever been to, with extraordinary food, lots of lovely tapas and pinchos, a lovely beach that is sort of stretches behind the main cinema, and just a really incredible old town. And the festival itself is very well organized, and there's a great vibe here. I totally recommend this festival for anyone wanting to sort of do a bit of traveling next year. Yeah, so I've been seeing lots of movies, of course. Like most festivals, they have a competition dedicated to new works, world premieres, and I've been looking at a couple of those. The first one I saw is a film called Ex-Husbands by a director called Noah Pritzker, and it stars the great Griffin Dunn, who we know from, who many will remember from Martin Scorsese's After Hours. And he stars opposite his After Hours co-star, Rosanna Arquette. as a recently divorced man who goes on a trip to Tulum in Mexico and bumps into his son, played by James Norton, who is there on a bachelor party, and they have a bit of a catch-up, and they do a bit of bonding, and there is some sort of familial revelations that come out, and it's a very charming film, and Griffin Dunne gives this very kind of avuncular performance, and yeah, it's almost like a sort of very happy clappy version of a Noah Baumbach film about dysfunctional families, and yeah, very enjoyable. Maybe it'll kind of make its way over to cinemas sometime. Another film I saw was called MMXX by the Romanian filmmaker Cristi Puiu. MMXX is actually the Roman numerals for 2020, and this is a bit of a kind of survey of life in that year via four like domestic scenes, and they were all the stories in this film were born out of actors' workshops, and you know they was built out of actually getting actors to improvise and work with Puiu to write a script. And I mean, one of the themes in the film is that sits in the backdrop is the pandemic, and I guess how the pandemic changed our lives on a domestic level. It's quite a tough film in the sense that it's very, very wordy. It's all the scenes take place in quite enclosed spaces, but it's also got a lot of humour in it as well, and irony, and tonally it moves all over the map. Not one of his like best films ever, but like definitely got loads and loads of good stuff in it. And you know, he is an incredible director. Also saw a film called A Silence by the Belgian filmmaker Joachim Le Fosse, who's done lots of films that Little White Lies have covered. Daniel Auteuil, he's a big shot lawyer covering a child abuse, a very, very kind of public tabloidy child abuse case. His wife is Emmanuel DeVos, who's kind of quietly serving him in the background. And it transpires that Otoy himself, or his character, is indeed has his own issues relating to the case, shall we say. And it's been kept a secret by his wife for 30 years. And the film kind of captures the moment where it all comes to a head. It's not an amazing film. It's a bit all over the place in terms of tone. And it feels a little bit sort of French drama slapdash. But yeah, it's a solid feature. Finally, I want to talk about a quick film called Un Amour by Isabelle Coisette, I think, I can't pronounce her surname, I'm really sorry. It stars Leia Costa as a woman who leaves the city for the country, buys a ramshackle old house, is kind of lost and depressed, and then she enters into this strange sex-based love affair with a kind of hulking local man who gives his services like as a handyman in exchange for some physical affection. And it's a very silly film. It plays like kind of Mills and Boone romance, and Leia Costa's good despite the fact that the script and the story kind of lets her down. But yeah, that's all from me. And yeah, thanks so much for listening. And yeah, see you at the next festival. Ciao.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Next up, it's the creator. Amidst a future war between the human race and the forces of artificial intelligence, Joshua, a hardened ex-special forces agent grieving the disappearance of his wife, is recruited to hunt down and kill the elusive architect of an advanced AI who has developed a mysterious weapon, power to end all of mankind, only to discover the world-ending weapon that he's been instructed to destroy is an AI in the form of a young child. But before we get into the film, I got to talk to its director, Gareth Edwards.
I'm very excited to talk to you, Gareth.
Hey, Layla, how you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I was at the Science Museum screening, and okay. I've just okay. been passing it over in my head ever since. I keep thinking of like new allegories for it. I mean, which ones did you have in mind? Because to me, I'm most kind of favorite about it being about the war on terror, I got to say.
Okay. I'll take that. No, it was a whole bunch of allegories, to be honest. Like, I think in metaphors, like, I sort of annoy people every time I talk about anything. I always go, you know, it's like, and I pick a metaphor. And so, like, filmmaking-wise, I can't help but try and find the metaphor for each thing that we're doing. And especially with a science fiction film, people have a million questions all the time because it's like a future world and questions, you know, about stupid things they shouldn't have questions about. Like, how did they get from there to there? And it's like, I don't know, a car. And like, yeah, but was it a flying car? And how does the flying car work? And it's like, oh God, who cares? And so you get bombarded with stuff. And one of the fastest solutions is to pick something in the real world and say, it's like that, you know, the future. And so the war on terror was one of those things, like Afghanistan. The idea, Osama bin Laden was kind of the creator in our movie, mm-hmm. was like, you know, from one person's point of view, he's the, you know, public enemy number one, the person they're all trying to get and can't. And from the other perspective, like sort of celebrated, well, in our movie, the AI think the creator is God. And so it's like a more extreme version of that. And so the idea of like a superpower with extreme, you know, advanced weaponry against a more guerrilla fighters, you know, on the ground. It's like, and I think whenever you made this film, if we made it like 30 years ago or some other era, people would say, oh, it's really timely, because sadly, we're just always doing that same kind of war somewhere in the world. So it wasn't like I had a big political agenda, but yeah, it's more like trying to find the real world equivalent of what's going on.
And that was one of the things I really appreciated about the film. You didn't kind of like spoon feed like exposition of like, this is exactly what everybody is and this is kind of their roles and this is how the tech works and stuff. You sort of, I mean, like, is part of your ethos to assume the audience is intelligent enough to not need to be spoon fed every last detail about this world you're building?
Or I'm too stupid to do a good job of it, probably. Yeah, I mean, my favorite kind of science fiction doesn't hold your hand the whole way through. Like, you have you should have just as many questions as you get answers. What's really difficult is to make a film like this, you have to do test screenings. So you show it to like 400, 500 people, and they all fill in these forms about what they loved and hated about the film. And the really brutal thing is you don't have time to read all what they loved, because you have to usually get to back into the edit the next day. So you have to skim read all the things they didn't like or didn't work. And so you're constantly trying to address those things, but in such a way that you don't play to the lowest common denominator. Mm. And the studio are really supportive like that. They'd done films. So their background was, they did movies like The Revenant and The Northman and The Lighthouse. And they're very filmmaker friendly, I think is the term. But so it was felt like the right place to do this with, because we didn't want to just do a cheesy blockbuster. You know, we wanted it to have a bit more about it if we could.
Yeah. I mean, like, one of the scenes that I enjoyed the most is, not to give spoilers away to listeners, but you know, the moment where they're kind of in a temple and you sort of see the integration of how like tech has done that, but you haven't done like a 5 minute, let me explain to you the way that simulants have like embraced religion. You know, like it was much more kind of, is it a visual language, I suppose? Is that the right way to describe it?
Yeah, I think it's a happy accident of shooting it the way we did. Like, it's not a spoiler for the film, it's a spoiler for a shot in the movie. There's a scene where they go in a temple, and we actually tried to find the like most interesting temple interior that we could in the whole of Thailand. And there was this one which was called the Sanctuary of Truth. and it was basically carved out of wood. And it looked stunning when you went inside it. And so all I'm doing is just looking at everything through a sci-fi lens. Mm-hmm. So the second you see all these like carvings of Buddhist iconography, you know, kind of carved into the wall, in my head, I'm thinking, well, that's going to be a robot, you know, carving. And so like, I got really excited about those sort of things. We do these little nice little dolly shots on some of this stuff. And then ILM turned it into robot equivalent, you know, as if they had for 1,000 years, robots had been worshipping sort of spiritual, like, gurus of robots. And that's the thing, is it shouldn't make, I don't know the answers to that. If someone said, okay, so what is that? Why is there a robot that's like as a sculpture inside a temple? What's going on now? My answer is, I don't know. I didn't get a chance to ask them, because like when you go to a real world location, like in Southeast Asia, there's so much going on that you don't understand. And that's what makes it real. And so with science fiction, I'm trying to do the same thing where, I mean, there is loads of crazy structures in this movie in the backgrounds of shots, and I don't know what they are. Like, I can tell you what I think they might be, but that was kind of the point, is we if something makes total sense, if it's very clear what everything is all the time, it doesn't feel real. And also it's boring. Like, my favorite thing in like the original Star Wars is shots like where on Mos Eisley suddenly like some legs will just walk past frame, and it won't pull wide to show you what those legs belong to. And you and all the fun of those movies is like just imagining what all these characters, how they even exist, what happened before and after the movie, and your imagination races and gets all overexcited about it. And in a weird way, when you get the answers, like, you know, when you kind of do this sort of like spin-off stuff, and half the time it's always better left to the imagination. And so there's so many things I tried to put in this film where I don't know. I can tell you my guess, but lots of details that I don't want to know the answer to, you know, that it was just there when we filmed it.
That is kind of strangely refreshing, because I feel like so many things of this, or at least that feel of this scale, just end up as like big exposition dumps and kind of also bridging to the next installation, or, you know, linking to the things before it. This is quite self-contained. I mean, was there pressure at all to kind of set it up more as something that could be a franchise or could kind of lead to sequels? Because this feels complete to me.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to. We've never talked about it, you know, only as a joke, like created to Electric Boogaloo, you know, kind of thing. Yeah, I often fall out when with my girlfriend, when we have a bit of a couple of hours to do something at home or watch something, we spend a good hour of that just deciding what to watch. And she always wants to watch some streaming, you know, TV show. And I always want to watch a movie. And at one point she's like, why don't you want to watch a TV show? And I thought about it. I was like, yeah, you're right. Why don't I want to watch a TV show? And it was like, you know what? My favorite part of a story is the end. And I'm kind of like, TV shows don't really end. And it's like my favorite part of a joke is the punchline, and everything is building up to that. And so I really like stories and films where self-contained, and it's kind of building to this climax, and then there's like a mic drop moment and it hits the credits. And like my favorite films do that really well. And so, yeah, I really didn't want there to be anything beyond this movie. And I do love the idea. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how people interpret it. But I like films where when you drive home from the cinema, you're arguing about what it meant and what happened after the credits rolled, you know, and all that kind of thing. Like, that's kind of, it's left to the audience. Like, it's a much more interactive experience when you've got something to think about and have an opinion on, you know. That's when it bounces around your head, after, you know, for a long time.
I have to say, I'm fully in agreement with you about the power of endings. I believe that a thing with a bad ending is not possible. The ending is the conceit. Did you have that kind of the way it would end in mind the entire time? Because I know this was, what, 5 years in the making?
So yes, the ending was always, everything worked back from this ending. Mm-hmm. I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but there's essentially a metaphor about a key location in the movie and what it means. And I like the idea that there was a literal situation that was to do with space and the military the war going on in our movie. But there was this kind of more fairy tale, like, misunderstanding by the child, and that also played out to be true. And I like the innocence of the kid and how, not quite understanding the world, she sort of misunderstood it, but then was right anyway. Mm-hmm. Really ambiguous. But if you've seen it, hopefully it makes sense. There's a line in the trailer that obviously maybe people have seen where she asks about heaven. So it's all kind of to do with that. And it's all working backwards from that idea.
Oh, I feel quite teary thinking about the line, about all of the kind of talk of heaven. It's very, very moving. Sorry, that's a digression. I wanted to ask you also about this idea, like something that's kind of followed you both with this film and with Monsters is like the idea that you get so much kind of like bang for your buck. You know, like the budgets are always smaller than what it feels like it is on screen. I mean, like, how do you sort of... that's obviously praise, but how do you feel about that sort of feedback?
It's great, obviously, and it was part of the plan. I do remember when we did Monsters, it was the common compliment was, I can't believe you did that for that budget, which always to me, because I'm very British about it, and I think everyone hates everything I do, and I hate everything I do. And so I'd always take that as like, oh, they didn't like it. That was just the best thing they could find to say. Was like, oh, it looked more than it cost, yeah. But it was attempts to be Monsters on steroids. And we had loads of money. Like, we had too much money. The final amount, because of COVID, went up to like about 80 million, allegedly. So that's a fucking shit ton of money. And I used to say to the people working on the film, no one can ever say on this movie, we can't afford to do that, because we only have $80 million, you know, like, you can do anything with that kind of money.
Well, you
and so
can.
The key was,
I think others can't.
And everyone can, they just, I don't know. But it's like, you get this crew small enough to a certain size, and it's cheaper to fly them anywhere in the world than it is to build a set. Mm-hmm. And so you're just trying to do things that you can be the most, like, you can be a very poor, cheap blockbuster, or you can choose to be the most expensive guerrilla movie ever made. And that was our goal. We're like, let's try to be like a small indie, but Industrial Light and Magic are doing all the VFX and Hans Zimmer's doing the score, you know what I mean, kind of thing. Like, it was trying to find that holy grail. And I don't think we bullseyed it, but I think we got close enough to be proud of, you know, what happened. But I do feel like an addicted gambler, where I come out of the casino and I'm like, oh, I know how to win next time. You know what I mean? Like, figured it out. I want to go back in, and like, it makes you want to make another film and get it even closer. But I don't know. It's exciting time to be a filmmaker. There's all these crazy things on the horizon, like with, AI obviously being a big one. When we were shooting this, or not when we were shooting, when I was in pre-production on this, I had a little tour of a virtual reality soundstage, you know, where you, like a motion, like a volume, you know, like they use an avatar and things like that. And they had a big poster on the wall, and it had how a movie is made. It had like a whole, like, this is the, like a Venn diagram thing. Like, this is how it's all done. And I was looking at it thinking, well, this is all really obvious. I don't know why they got this poster up. And the owner went, oh, I see you noticed the poster. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, you know, that's over 100 years old. And then I realized it's a bit tatty and a bit faded. And then I just thought, like, laughed, like, God, we haven't changed how we make a film in 100 years. Like, we have these all amazing new tools constantly. But everyone who arrives, you know, to make films gets forced to do it the way everyone's ever done it. And it feels like it doesn't have to be everybody, but for some people, there's different ways of making movies. There's like, and when you're on the outside looking in, like we were with Monsters, it was like in your head, it's like, without knowing how you're supposed to make a film, I think you should do it like this. This makes the most sense. And then you get told, no, that's not how it's done, kid. You know, it's like, you know, this other way. And then you do the other way and you go, I don't think this is right. Like, I don't think this leads to the best result. And so whatever happens in the future now, I don't know what's going to come of any of this. If I get to make another film, I don't want to go back to that other way. Like, I feel very excited about like pushing this even further next time.
I mean, I do kind of, like, I don't want to like psychoanalyze you or anything, but like, it does feel that like that sort of drive to be pushing yourself to be like, oh, okay, we got close, but we could do even better next time, results in the sort of like, you know, everyone's talking about like how gorgeous this film is, like, does that like help with the sort of ambition of things? Because like, so many things just feel lazy. Like, you'll just see like a conversation in a blockbuster movie that they've just green screened it because they couldn't get all the actors on time. Like, do you think you're pushing yourself because you just want to get better and better and better every time and not rest on your laurels?
This sounds like therapy, doesn't it?
It does. Sorry.
No, I'll say, well, I think what I'd say is Okay, this is not me fishing for a compliment or being like falsely humble. I feel I fail at everything I do. Mm-hmm. I feel like whatever I do, I see all the faults in it, and then I beat myself up afterwards for not having done it better. And so every time you go, I think it's one of those things you can never, ever achieve. Whatever you aim for, you're going to be lucky to get like 2/3 of the way there. And so if you aim to make a good movie, you'll make an average movie at best. So you have to, at the start of making a film, aim to make the greatest movie in the history of cinema. And then you might make a good movie. You know what I mean? You're never going to actually pull that off unless you're James Cameron or Spielberg or someone, but you're never going to pull it off. And so all you do each time when you dust yourself off and get back out the ditch is you go, okay, how do we do better next time? How do we not make the fuck ups, whatever we did? How do we... And you try to, like, I think cinematography wise on this one with Greg and Oren, we sat for a long time on Zoom doing these conversations. We had all this reference of photography, and I basically collected over years, for every scene in the movie, imagery that I kind of went, this to me feels like what that scene should feel like. Mm-hmm. And we had it, like, had too much imagery, and then I had to get it down to just a handful for each scene. And we noticed that every time we looked at images and broke it down and went, what's going on here? And it was great to have Greg as part of that, because you make an assumption about how an image is made and you end up kind of getting it wrong. Like, normally it's very simple, like very, it's one light, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You know, when you see those YouTube videos of people trying to recreate something from Blade Runner or something, and they've got all these lights everywhere. And then you actually ask the people that did it and they say, oh, it's one light, just came through the window, and then we just bounced something back. Yeah. Like, very, very simple. And so it was finding the very simple version of everything. And we ended up with this little rule book, and we did things very differently. Like, there's a load of new technology that came out. So just after Star Wars, I sort of dived into buying loads of camera equipment to try. I was like, if I don't get a chance to do this a movie the way I want to, I'm just going to do it myself with my own money. And so I started buying all this camera equipment, trying to figure it out. And there's, as everyone knows who tries to make films, there's like gimbals now, like the stabilize shots that you mm-hmm. can hold in your hand. We used this camera called an FX3 by Sony, which is very small. It shoots at 12,800 ISO. So basically it can work in moonlight. It's so sensitive to light. And that suddenly meant we didn't need these giant lights everywhere. So we had like battery operated lights. And if we had battery operated lights, we could start doing things like, I was like, well, instead of having them on stands, and every time you shoot in one direction and you have to turn the other direction, you have to move all the stands and it takes 20 minutes. Why can't we just have people, just like they hold the microphone on a stick, on a boom, can't we have the lights on a boom? And then as I turn the camera, they quickly move, and like within 5 seconds, we've relit the scene. And so we did all stuff like that. But, you know, drone technology had come on a lot, like, on Star Wars, the drone we had was like a mini helicopter and it crashed all the time. And now, you know, we all know them. You can have one in your pocket that's like cinema resolution. And so there's all these little things that mean you can go about things differently and liberate yourself a bit. And we just tried to abuse them all, basically.
Well, I mean, clearly in the best way. I really, really like the film. I'm very excited to see what you do next. And thank you for your time. And yeah, keep beating yourself up and feeling like you need to push yourself more, because I think it just really yields great results.
Don't worry, I've already started the beating up thing. Thank you for supporting the films. You've been so kind. Your publication has always been amazing to me. And they did that one little spread thing where someone did an illustration of my head exploding and they sent it to us, and my girlfriend framed it, zipping in her house. So it's like a constant reminder of how stupid I am.
You know, we do what we can. Oh, yeah, great. Have a lovely rest of the day, and congrats on everything.
So, Hannah, we went to the Science Museum to watch this last night, which is just like the perfect place to watch a movie like this that is fundamentally asking you to be very pro-science. Surprisingly pro-AI message that came from this one.
Yeah, unfortunate timing. Yeah, considering like all the kind of debate over the past year or so. I mean, AI's been a big thing in Hollywood for years, but it does feel like it's kind of ramped up in the past couple of years. And obviously that was kind of the key to the WGA and the SAG-AFTRA strikes, is the kind of concerns about AI in art and the place it has. And this film isn't really concerned with those questions, I would say. It's more a kind of film about tolerance and acceptance. And the AI is a metaphor for humanity and how humanity should come together, which, you know, I was like, yeah, sure. Like, we've seen that before many a time. I will say, like, I think it looks really great. I think that Gareth Edwards is very good at the spectacle of these, like, big films, obviously, like Rogue One and Godzilla and the kind of monsters films at his, like, where he came up. Though he's had a big gap between Rogue One and The Creator. So, he you know, he's been away. He's kind of had time to think and come up with this very, like, detailed world. I think that the kind of the look and the, like, lived-in details of this continent, the supercontinent known as New Asia, where AI has kind of found a safe haven and become embraced, and you see robots kind of living in houses and working in fields and having, you know, family kind of relationships with humans, and it's all very cozy, and it feels very detailed. And I kind of liked the world itself more than the story I was being told, because I found the story not particularly compelling or original. And I don't know, I maybe I'm heartless, because I was just like thinking all the way through, like, there's something that Joshua says at the beginning, he's like, oh, it's just programming. Like, that's how what he keeps telling himself. And that's just what I kept thinking all the way through. I was like, yeah, but, like, fundamentally, it's still coding. Like, these are not human beings. These are robots. Like, I just kept thinking that even, like, even though the robot looks like a very cute little child, like, it's still a robot. Like, I was kind of like, dude, come on, get a grip. Like, though, I mean, in you know, there's kind of like, there's ways they, like, talk around that and justify the film's internal logic. But, yeah, I don't know. I just, like, I was hoping for something more interesting than I think we actually got from this film.
Yes, but what is DNA if not programming meat? So maybe we are not so different from these people. Yeah, I mean, obviously, whilst his entire industry is fighting against the plight of AI, he mentioned this is like 5 years in the making. He didn't know that this is the environment that this was going to come out to. But beyond that sort of unfortunate satire, I mean, it's very clearly a bit about the war on terror, about the war in Vietnam and that stuff. I mean, did that sort of messaging work for you, Elena?
No. I actually found it very strange and suspect, I would say, the whole imagery of Vietnam in this film set in 2065
is the first, and then it skips forward
five years
so 2070, then end up in 2070.
I found it
it's very soon.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, and that's interesting to make a film that would be set so soon with AI and stuff. I was kind of on board with the whole idea for, like, not the first half, but, like, the first, I don't know, third or whatever, because it's quite a long movie. I was kind of interested, and I thought it did look amazing, and just the detail of it and the world and just the way it's shot, like, just even just people talking, it's just shot really well. It's like a proper movie. But yeah, as soon as it started being about, like, John David Washington with this robot bomb child, I was just like, what's going on here? Like, and before that, as I said, the imagery of Vietnam, where, so it's not just like they're in Asia and they have helicopters and weapons, it's also they listen to, like, music from the 70s, and I'm like, what's, like, this is literally 100 years before their time. Why are they listening to this? There have been many wars since. They would listen to different music. I think people in, you know, in the Middle East right now are probably not listening to this. And I was just like, what does this mean? And so I think it's kind of like just vibes. This whole thing of having Vietnam is literally just because it looks like other films about wars. Okay, that's it. I don't think there's anything more to this. But basically, I agree with Anna, but it made me more angry than you, Anna, the whole thing, because I do think there is a connection between this film about AI and the way people are talking about AI today. And this film shows a way that things could go, I think, with AI, which is that because AI is cute and because AI does nice things to us, people are going to be ready to defend AI more than themselves and their own rights and their own, like, social, you know, and to use actual social tools to improve existence. And so there's this complete contradiction in this film where basically the people who want to defend AI are saying these robots, they don't call them robots, they call them simulants, they have treated me better than any human would. Therefore, that's why they want to defend them. And I'm like, that's the point. That's because they're robots. They were made to serve you. That's literally what they were made. And at no point does the film even question this. At no point does this film discuss the idea of consent from robots. It talks a lot about the freedom of the robots, the freedom of the AI. But what does this mean? It doesn't explain what that means at all. All the robots we see, they're very nice because they help humans. There's no point where the robots are like, we just want to be among ourselves, our robot selves, and not serve any human. There's no discussion of this at all. So the film, I was kind of hoping for the film to address these questions because that's interesting and because that's kind of the dilemma that the main character has, John David Washington, you know, because the whole thing is like, I have to kill this robot that could be responsible for the destruction of the human race. But he changes his mind, but basically the dilemma for him isn't, is this robot sentient? Does it have a life? Should I respect this life? It's just, this is a robot in the shape of a child, therefore I can't kill it. And that just really annoyed me. I'm like, are you serious? If that's the level, we're doomed. Like, if all it takes is for the robot to be in a cute shape, to not destroy a weapon, like, okay, well, end the film there. I don't know. Like, it just made me very angry. It just made me very, very angry. And also, especially after we've had Spielberg's AI that addressed all these questions really beautifully and ahead of its time. You know, AI wasn't as much of a concern at the time, or, you know, it seemed more like it would be far away. Now it's very close. And it addressed all these questions. It was the same thing. It was a child that's an AI who wants to be a real boy, like Pinocchio. And it addressed all those questions in a very intelligent way. That was never like, we need to protect this child because he's cute, you know? I don't know. It just made me very angry. Sorry, I'm just ranting now, but it's just such a shame because it looks so beautiful. It could be such a great film. It's clearly a lot of money and talent involved. And then it just sort of fizzles out about what it's about. And it's just like, you're supposed, because you've been bombarded by these very, very, very violent images of warfare where most of the people killed, some are humans, but most of them are robots. They are literally images of like genocide of AI, which are, you know, it's horrible to watch, but they're robots. And you're bombarded by these images to the point where you're supposed to kind of feel empathy for the robots. And that's just a shame to use all this talent and money and energy to make this point. It just made me very angry. Anyway.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that, like, as people have been, like, praising about this, a film that I liked a lot more than you did. But I think it's $80 million that this cost. And,
oh, like, that's not bad.
In contrast, I believe that, I think it was Thor Love and Thunder to cost $350 million.
Yeah. Actually, that's not bad. I take it back. That's not that much money. But it could have been a great film. Like, it just looks the business, and it's got good actors, and it's got interesting, it starts in a very interesting place, and then it just goes in a not interesting place for me. And so I felt kind of cheated. I was just like, well, why seduce me with all these incredible locations and shots and characters and then go there, you know?
I think it maybe needs a softer touch. Because what you mentioned about like the idea of like how AI interacts with other AI and kind of like this idea of like AI communities and how they interact with humans, how they feel about humans is something we don't really get a lot of in the film. The kid just keeps saying, we want to be free. And it's like, but what does freedom look like for you guys? Like what would be freedom? And it made me think of a lot of films. I did think about AI for one, but also like, this is going to sound a bit weird, but Spike Jonze's Her, like, because that whole film is about like the relationship between humans and artificial intelligence, and particularly artificial intelligence that can grow and learn and quote unquote feel. And that film kind of ends in a place of like AI banding together and be like, we don't want to be here with the humans. We don't like this. We want to go somewhere else and be among ourselves. Like, I don't know, maybe that feels more like true to me. Maybe I'm like just so jaded that I'm like, well, why would a kind of intellectually superior being choose to stay among the humans, particularly after being subjugated for all these like decades? I don't know. I think maybe it did need a little bit of a softer touch in terms of the plot, and maybe could have been more like Terrence Malick in its kind of like, you know, approach to like these big ethical questions. Because I do think that there's an interesting film here, and I do think it looks amazing. But it just feels like a really conventional story told in a very nice way, like a very, you know, attractive visual style.
There's also a really interesting question the film does not address, which I thought was, it's like there, staring at you the whole time, because basically the idea is that the West has stopped using AI because AI bombed Los Angeles with a nuclear weapon. So they like banned AI and they're at war with AI. But New Asia still uses AI. And so there's this very interesting thing that happens, because when we go to New Asia, you see that most of the place is quite rural. It's a bit like Asia, I guess, today. Very rural and very poor people. And all these poor people, but, you know, it's literally Vietnam imagery. They need AI. They love AI because AI gives them a better life. And I'm like, well, that's a very interesting question. Like, maybe is that why New Asia keeps using AI? Because these people are so poor that if they can have this robot helping them around the house and like doing stuff, that's like very valuable to them. And whereas in the West, we don't need this because we have way better like life, you know, life, like it's easier life. And the film doesn't address this. And instead it's like, no, it's because people in Asia are nice to it. Like, why is any of this happening? And that would be the question you would want to answer in a film about this. You know, there's the villain is amazingly played by Allison Janney, who's like the boss of the army, she's great. I love her. And she's like, we need to kill them because they're robots and they're taking over the world and they bombed Los Angeles and they could bomb the rest of the world. And she, I would love to hear more from her. Like, what are her points? Like, she's not just an evil whatever. Like, they have good reason to do what they're doing. And the film doesn't address those questions. And there's so many, in that world, there are so many questions that are just unanswered. Like, why is the number one weapon of the West this like huge sort of plane thing that floats over the world and drops bombs? How is that sustainable in a world where AI exists, where AI could build their own weapons that would destroy this in 5 seconds? I'm like, what is the logic? And there's just so many of those things like this that are like not resolved.
But they have built a thing that can destroy all of it in
They could probably just build loads of little planes. I don't know. They could do like, how did it get to the point where this is the weapon that the West has and they rely on this one weapon for their entire survival? I'm like, in what world? Like, in how does that make sense? You know, and because you have so much time in the film, you have time to think about this stuff. You know, if the film was like shorter and like more like just, it's very appealing. So there is a point where I was not thinking about this because I was like, this is very appealing to watch. But after a while, I'm like thinking about it and I'm like, okay, when is this going to come up? When are we going to discuss this? Because it's important. This is the why of everything that's happening. And it's just not mentioned. It's just not discussed.
Oh, I see, because I found that like really interesting, the way that essentially that you've got your kind of imperial US who has kind of used technology to destroy, and the other side has sort of embraced that kind of like nurtures them. And to me, it wasn't really a thing of like AI or not AI. It's just sort of a thing of like, well, we're going to like invest into the intelligence of drone warfare versus kind of outreach to like various communities and stuff. I mean, to be honest, like I've seen some really fascinating takes on like the interiority of AI. Like obviously Her is wonderful. I loved After Yang last year, and this whole questions about if a robot could be human, would it choose to? I just felt like that's not what we were doing. We were doing like Starship Troopers, you know? We were doing kind of like, you just kind of accept these people as being like another species. Like it's very low on the kind of science level of things, and it kind of doesn't really seek to explain much of like how all this works. So it's more kind of like a critique of imperialism, but also just like a return to like the big splashy mid-budget movies that we don't get that much anymore.
But so if that's the point, why not just make them aliens? If they were aliens, they were beings, they have interiority, they're like some kind of animal, you know, like that would make sense, but they literally are not. They were made by people. They were made by humans to serve us.
But that's what the thing is, like, that we've got like a responsibility for them.
If we don't, it's like a toaster.
But I suppose that's what District 9 did.
I don't know. It's like a toaster. You turn it off if you don't need it. I don't know. It's just like, it really frustrates me because it's literally not the same as another species. It's not the same as aliens. It's not the same as anything else. It's like, and the film, I think it's one of those things as well. It's just playing with like emotionality in this perverse way. Where it's like the only reason is because they're nice and it's sad to kill things. Like, yes, but you're not killing, you're destroying a machine. Like, I don't know. Oh, it just like, yeah, it just lost me in a big way after a while. But great performances.
How do you feel at the end of Terminator 2, I'm wondering? As he descends into the lava, are you just like, just turning him off?
That's how I feel. I'm like, he'll be
back. It's fine. It's fine. You know, he did what he had to do.
I love this. The amount of sympathy you guys can have for Jigsaw this. But this little adorable baby robot that just wants to end up in heaven. No, Cole.
Hey.
Does nothing for you.
Tell you a robot I like, the Iron Giant. Now that gets me. That gets me. That guy can stay.
A robot and an alien.
Yes, exactly.
Well, there you go. Exactly. There you go. That's fine. That would be a different business. If those AI in the film came from another planet, where that's their form of intelligence, whatever, like that would be way more complicated. That would be like, maybe, you know, I don't know. Anyway, yeah, it did not work.
You know what? When we kind of looked at setting this up, I assumed that I was going to be on my own saying that I love Saurix and then like unanimous for the creator. But no, I right after, I had a great time and I accept your criticisms, but reject internalizing them. So, Hannah, do you want to go first with your in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I think it's a 4 in anticipation. I'd heard some good stuff about this. I will say, like, the critical reception has been very good. I think that Elena and I are maybe in the minority widely in that we were just kind of like, I've got some questions about this one. Enjoyment, probably a 3. Yeah, I mean, I had an okay time watching it. It does feel long. There's a lot of, like, moving around, which I think is not always the most cinematic. Just kind of like, okay, now we're in this location, and now here I have to get to another location. I'm just like, oh my God, like, another one? Like, I don't know. It felt very, like, derivative of other things I've liked. Like, it felt like The Mandalorian, and, you know, I feel a bit sorry for Gareth Edwards. It's kind of hard to get away from the Star Wars allegations after you've made one. In retrospect, I'm going to say 3 for now, but maybe a 2. I don't know. Like, this conversation's been very interesting, because I think I am maybe between the two of you in kind of where I would say I am with the film. I don't know. I just think, like, AI is such an interesting topic, and I don't think this film is asking the questions that I have and that I think we should be moving on to. It feels like a film from like 10 years ago, which you can kind of tell that it's had a long gestation period, but it's still very much like Gareth, and I'm very happy that he has made a new film, and it is a win for, like, original storytelling, which we don't get that much of, and, you know, original in that it's not an existing franchise. At least I don't think the story itself is that original, but 4-3-3 for me.
Elena, what about you?
I would say anticipation 3, because I found the trailer incredibly uninspiring. It was just so dour and strange, and I couldn't get what was going on. It was such a strange trailer. I recommend watching it. It's very odd. But I had heard very good things, and it did look really good, so I was kind of curious. Enjoyment, I would say also 3, because I did enjoy a lot of it, like the first half or the first third or whatever. I was very, very happy to see a film that had proper, like, shots and proper images and all that. And it was truly stunning and truly just well shot and beautifully made. And some fun bits of, like, editing and fun bits of, like, with the music that maybe are a bit cheesy and weird, but I actually kind of admired this, like, boldness in the hues of music. But then it really, really lost me, as I said. So yeah, 3. And then in retrospect, 2, because I think it's low-key evil, what it's doing. And I was saying, I'm really glad that when I went to see this film, the news of the strike ended had just arrived, and I was very happy, because it would have, otherwise the film would have really made me really depressed. But I was like, maybe we're going to win this fight against these robots and the people who want to defend them. So that's my verdict.
Yeah, I mean, that is very fair enough. There are some real concerns, and, like, the timing of this, I don't think anyone would argue, was great. But yeah, I think this just kind of took me back to not even 10 years ago, like, to the 80s, to sort of, like, E.T., to, like, Blade Runner, to perhaps when this wasn't, like, such a tangible threat where we're all going to be swallowed whole because some idiot tech bro makes a coding error. Yeah, I thought it was gorgeous. I thought when I saw the budget for it, that was really, really impressive. And I just had a great time. And I hope this is the sort of thing that does well and at least kind of inspires Hollywood that you don't need to give $300 million to Taika Waititi to have, like, a huge amount of contempt for his audience. And it seems me in particular. You can give Gareth Edwards 80. He'll come back with something where he actually looks like he gave a damn the whole way through.
I don't think you should give Taika $300,000 either. Just don't give
them.
But actually, just to go back on what you're saying, like, I think it's very interesting to think that Blade Runner and AI, two films made more than 20 years ago, had more to say and were more grappling with the actual moral and ethical questions of AI in a much more direct way than this film, which this film is made now at a time when AI is close by. I think that's very interesting. And I think that's what makes me really doubt about what's the deal with this movie and why is it trying to make me like AI? Why is it such AI propaganda coming at this time now when AI is arriving?
Is Gareth Edwards AI?
Yeah, is he even human?
Did you care when those robots died? Just
which ones?
Blade Runner.
Yes, they have a tragic life. They're born to die, you know? They're never alive, really. They're born dead.
See, that's the thing. We understand, like, how they're in bondage. Like, in this film, it's just like, the Americans keep bombing us. And it's like, yeah, that sucks. That really sucks. We should work on that. But, like, they have found, like, a haven on Earth. Like, I also just have questions about the government. Like, why are America allowed to do that? Like, why is no other country like, hey, no.
As a person who grew up in North Africa and the Middle East, I could say this was accurate to my lived experience of America imperialism.
That this is very true.
Maybe that's yeah. what
I mean that.
What's that? You don't think we're human? Okay.
Maybe if I just was reading it as like an allegory for that, yeah, you'd be okay. Yeah,
but that's why they should be aliens and not AI, because AI is real. Not the way they're making it, but...
Aliens aren't real? God, you have the best hit, people. Don't believe what they found in Mexico.
We should move on to a more beloved figure that we can all get behind. Let's revisit the first time we met Jigsaw in 2004 Saw.
Photographer Adam Steinheit and oncologist Lawrence Gordon regain consciousness while chains of pipes at either end of a filthy bathroom. As the two men realize that they've been trapped by a sadistic serial killer named Jigsaw, they must complete his perverse puzzle to live. So, Elena, did you watch this in order? Was your first Saw 1?
That's a very good question. I assume so, because otherwise, I mean, why complicate things even more for myself? I think it probably was the first one. Yeah, and it's actually kind of cute watching it now, because it's actually such a small, tiny movie, you know. I think it was a Sundance sensation, if I remember. And yeah, it's like all taking place in one room, and like, oh, you know, it's kind of cute. And also you have famous actors, you know, Cary Elwes delivering, as usual, a delightful performance. You know, Danny Glover is there. And like, it's just, you know, we haven't, I guess the only film where we reached that level again was Spiral. And we know how that went. So yeah, it's kind of amazing watching it now, because it's kind of hard, I imagine. I mean, I obviously didn't see it when it first came out, but it's kind of interesting to imagine that. Did anyone involved with this film, or even people who liked the film at the time, did we know that it would spawn like a really strange franchise of almost direct-to-video level quality sometimes, with extremely complicated plots, and kind of create an aesthetic of watching people in traps being tortured? So yeah, I think it's kind of like, yeah, it's like looking, when you watch it now, it's kind of like, oh, cute, you know. And it's also just really well made, and it's got a great crazy aesthetic of like, you know, they do this thing of editing and like people like freaking out and like overimposing images and stuff. That's just really, really fun. And they do a bit of that in the new one in a cute way. And also the music, obviously, iconic song cue that comes out at the right moment in the new film as well. We didn't talk about that. But yeah, I really like it, and it holds up.
I feel like we're talking about this with like the level of affection that most people talk about like Richard Curtis films. it's lovely. It's lovely to be back. I did see this when it first came out, though. It was huge. It was like Blair Witch Project of like, yeah, this thing made for like no money, and it's making, I think it made over like $100 million. But the ad campaign on a lot of buses was that you have to see Saw, which I'm still not forgiven. But yeah, I loved it then. I love it now. But yeah, there's something like weirdly nostalgic coming back to it.
I can't believe it's 20 years old. Like, that's crazy to me. I mean, I was a kid when this came out, and I remember it being like the film that people would talk about in the playground. So it's like, oh my God. Obviously, we were all like 12, so there was no way we could have seen it. But we were like, oh my God, have you heard about this film? Saw, a guy saws his foot off. And now it's like, that wouldn't even like register as like a big horror film. Because this was like, before the Hostel films, before that kind of like new wave of like extreme violence in horror movies had kind of kicked up again. And rewatching it, I've rewatched it a few times, like since I first saw it. I don't know, like maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Finally got around to it, and it's just, yeah, you watch it, and it still holds up. I think if you don't know the twists, because there are some twists in this film, I can only imagine how audiences reacted, like when they were watching this in the cinema, when Tobin Bell gets up at the end and walks out, like that would have blown my tiny mind. Like just an incredible reveal. And yeah, at Charlie Krause's music, Nine Inch Nails have really like done well for themselves in the film space. I feel like I find Lee Wannell very charming as a screen presence, which is not something that I get to say very often. He doesn't really act anymore since he became a prolific filmmaker in his own right, and I wish that James Wan would make another horror film, because like he's really good at it, and I find it much more interesting than whatever he's doing in the Aquaman space. I do think it's a very entertaining film that you kind of, now it's so hard to go back and look at it and like just see it in isolation from what it's become, because it's become, you know, this juggernaut which has just inspired so many other films. If you kind of reference Saw, I would say even people who aren't really into films would probably kind of know what you're talking about. That's the extent like to which the franchise has permeated popular culture. And yeah, it's just nice to go back and look at a film as iconic as this and be like, oh no, actually it's a well-crafted horror film that does a lot with a little and still even now holds up, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, holds up if anything has kind of improved, I think. I mean, at the time, one of my favorite things is going back with the film club and checking what the Rotten Tomatoes scores were. Like, not great.
Really?
I think you got like 48%. Yeah.
Maybe this was a sort of time when like horror films were just generally not really liked that much, you know. Like, I think even, I don't know how, actually, would that be interesting. I don't know how the Blair Witch Project was, what the critics said about it. Like, obviously now it's an iconic movie, but I don't know if at the time people really liked the critics really bothered with horror that much. I don't know. Also, like, yeah, as we said, like, the new film is really funny and, like, sort of knowing. And I think you could argue that the original Saw is kind of, I mean, all the twists, like, the twists you mentioned, is I think you're supposed to laugh. Like, you're supposed to be like, what? You know, like, it's kind of, and I can see how some, you know, audiences might think that's silly, you know? It's great. It's pleasure. It's joy.
Yeah, I mean, the final moment of the original Saw film where the door slams is such a dark punch to the heart. And actually, the final moments of Saw X are very uplifting. I would say feel good.
Yeah, I like that contrast between the two. And I do think, like, all the best horror films, in my opinion, have at least some element of, like, comedy or humour to them. Like, something like The Shining, which people debate if that's a horror film. But, like, you know, there are funny moments in that film. And even in Lee Wannell's The Invisible Man, there are funny things that happen within that film. So I do think, like, that humour has kind of always been in the franchise. And maybe it's played up a little bit more in Saw X. But certainly, like, the audacious twist in Saw is something that I think no other horror film maybe has been able to kind of carry something off to that impact, like, in the past 2 decades. Not that I can think of.
Actually, you were saying James Wan needs to do another horror film, but he did Malignant.
Oh my god, yes!
Which also has some twist. Like crazy stuff at the end. So it's, I think it's something he likes to do, I guess. God, and it's very funny. It's a very funny film. No, I'm sure you love Malignant. I know it wasn't a slight on your part. Great film. Wonderful movie. But yeah, also very funny. Like, horrible and very funny, you know?
I feel like, you know, with like Ari Aster and everyone, it's all like, it's all got very like serious and, you know, like, yes, what are the deep themes here? And obviously, like, the Halloween franchise was like, oh, it's all about trauma now. And I'm just like, ah, sometimes you just need a maniac and like, and a kind of like,
who's really good at his job.
A competent maniac and a...
And time management. Yes, a competent maniac. That's what you need.
And a script delivered with total sincerity. Like, everyone in Saw is, like, delivering their line readings as if it's Shakespeare. And I love that. I love that, like, commitment to it. And, yeah, I just, like, rewatching it for the podcast, I was just like, oh, I'm just having such a good time with this film. And you know, it sometimes it's as simple as that. You want to be entertained with a horror film, and this is like just such an entertaining film to watch.
Yeah. And I just love like thinking back that you think it was made by, I think, like $1 million. And, you know, you've got a couple of better known actors that are in it. And you basically have Tobin Bell in one scene actually doing anything. And like, what a absolute coup that guy that you basically just hired to like lie on the floor for most of this movie turned out to be an incredible screen presence and would become a beloved horror icon.
One of the like great, I mean, there's been a few kind of stories throughout time of like someone being so good in a role that they decided to write them in like into more of the scripts, but like I do love it when we hear about those stories where someone was just like so good that the screenwriters realized we need more of this guy, we need to see more of him. And I mean the origin story of this film as well, in that like Lee Wannell thought he had a brain tumor, which is kind of where that whole subplot comes from, because he had this thought of like, wow, if I got a brain tumor, like what would I do, you know, with the time before I died? And like,
oh my,
this is what he came up with.
Oh my god,
this is where he went with that.
A film about a guy who has only a few weeks to live and who would use this time to kill people. That was his answer. Wow.
And then trap a load of writers and directors in a 20-year spiral of trying to figure out what we do now that that timeline has been established.
Australians are built different. Like,
but before we wrap up, Elena, any last thoughts on this beloved Christmas movie of yours?
Oh, actually, that's a good point. I don't know when, what are the two Saw films we're set to watch this Christmas. I think it might be go back to Saw 1. So I'm very excited to watch it again. Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's wonderful. It's just a delightfully low-key thing where everything began. And yeah, as we said, it's just we've got this like nostalgic fondness for it now, which is funny, but it's still kind of like really tense and like scary and horrible. And I kind of like that the so small scale element of the trap, which is like the guy tied up to a radiator has to saw off his own leg. How beautiful is that? The simplicity, you know, maybe John Kramer's masterpiece. So yeah, it's great. I love it.
It is funny how things kind of just become like revisiting old friends if you just give them enough time. When Billy the Puppet arrived in Saw X, I nearly like punched the air and let out a little squeal of joy. I was so happy to see him.
I was very happy to see him, and also just like charmed by like, they must have been so like pleased with themselves like writing that scene in, because it goes on for quite a while. Like he really slowly like enters the shot, and like for the characters, it's like, what who's this guy? Like, they don't know. They don't know the law. But for me in the audience, I'm having a great time. I'm thinking, wow, John Kramer's puppetry has really come on since the war. Like he's been working away. Like he's found time between working on his traps to also work on his like masterful puppetry. So,
I mean, yeah. He does say he has several hobbies.
Several hobbies.
Also, the reactions from everyone in the first Saw film and in the new Saw film are really good. Like, they're just, in the new one, there are some amazing reactions though, from the people being trapped out. Just so brilliant. Because some of the other films, you know, it's just people screaming the same thing over and over. And this film is so, it feels like they actually took their time being like, okay, how would I scream in this moment? Like, how would my character feel seeing Billy the Puppet enter the room? It's really good.
And also a lot of moments of like, okay, this is horrible, but also you're being really
exactly. They're acknowledging how weird this is, which is great. Like, whereas in some of the other films, they're like, oh no, I'm scared. Instead of like, I'm scared and very confused, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think we become desensitized, don't we? Because obviously like, we've seen the films, you know, you kind of like, after a while, you're like, oh yeah, no, okay, I know how it all works, but the characters obviously don't. So there's like a great line reading in the new one where a guy goes, you sick son of a bitch. Yeah, you would say that because it is like, it's really messed up. It's not like garden variety, like, oh, just like stabbing someone and done with it. Like, it's weird. Yeah, thank you for acknowledging that in the comments. The franchise.
Yeah, there is a scream of why.
Yes, so good.
Because it's also like, yeah, sure, you're angry, sir. We scammed you, but also, what is going on?
You've escalated things with your reaction.
Ah, So, I mean, I don't know that there's much more that we could recommend than like just watching those over and over again. But Hannah, do you want to tell us what your one last thing is? What is your non-movie recommendation?
So, I mean, technically it's like tangentially movie related. I've been reading the novel Strangers by Tachi Yamada, which is the basis for the new Andrew Hay film, All of Us Strangers, which is at the London Film Festival, and it will be out in the UK, I believe, sometime in the new year. It's with Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal, and I absolutely love the film. I adored it, so I decided to read the novel that it's based on, which is a Japanese novel that was only translated like fairly recently, I believe. It's from the 80s, I think, the book, but anyway, as often is the case, it didn't get translated for a very long time. And it's this story about a man who revisits his childhood home and finds his parents, who have been dead since he was a child, are seemingly alive again, and they look exactly the same as they did when they passed away. So it's kind of a ghost story, but not in the kind of traditional way. And it's just, I'm about halfway through it now, and the book is really great. It's very different from the film as well. So it's a fun one to kind of read before you watch or after you watch, I guess, and kind of compare and contrast like how Andrew Hay has translated and transformed the story through his own kind of like queer lens and his own like British lens, I guess. But it's very good. Highly recommend.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I'm very excited. The buzz around that film has been coming from all the right people for me. So like, I think I'm going to love it. But order wise, book then film then book?
I watched the film first just because I didn't have time to start the book. I think if you want to kind of go for full emotional like devastation, maybe watch the film first, maybe go in not knowing anything other than what I've just said, because that's not really a spoiler. Because there's some stuff that I did not see coming and it really like floored me. But there's enough that's different about the book and the kind of tone, I guess, of the book compared to the film.
And Elena, what about you? What are you highly recommending to us?
So it's the same thing. It's a book, but it's tangentially related to film, because that's how we live. It's called My Face for the World to See by Alfred Hayes. And it's actually a book from 58. And it's interesting because I picked it up, as I usually do with books. I just go to a charity shop and I read the back and I pick it up. I rarely go looking for something specific. And it's about a very depressed screenwriter in Hollywood. So I was like, yeah, I'm picking that up. And it's very slim, so that's another reason. And turns out I then read the biography of this author, and he worked as a screenwriter on like Bicycle Thieves and some of The Twilight Zone and Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and you know, he wrote Paisa, and like, he's just a legend and a very interesting life. And then this book is really interesting. I'm not completely done with it. I have a few pages left, and yeah, it's about this screenwriter writing in a first person, so I assume very close to his own experience. And he's just, it's so interesting because it's set in 1958, I assume, you know, the 50s. But it's kind of strange because it feels like I was kind of like freaked out by how much I could relate to what this guy was feeling, and about Hollywood, but just about being, you know, a supposedly creative person trying to, you know, make ends meet, and just, you know, a bit blasé about the whole film industry, and as in, you know, the contrast between like being someone who's supposed to be creative, but also living in a place where you're surrounded by people who are supposed to be creative, and then it ends up being something else. And basically, he's at a party and he sees a girl who just walks into the ocean and basically tries to kill herself, and then it's about their relationship. But it's a very sort of, you know, none of them are very enthusiastic about it because they're both of them depressed in different ways. And it's just, I was like, the prose is absolutely gorgeous. Some of the things at the end that happen are a bit too like psychoanalytic in the psychoanalysis in the 50s 60s, which is a bit like, okay, like she's just saying the trauma that happened to her, and I'm like, no, that's, I don't think that would happen that way. But the prose is absolutely beautiful, and just a beautiful surprise. It's just great when you pick up something by chance and it turns out to be a little gem. So yeah, I recommend it.
Oh,
That sounds absolutely incredible. I just also feel like you have much better charity shops near you than I do. Like, mine seems to all just be like biographies of Sharon Osbourne.
Oh, man, I'm so well served with charity shops. It's crazy. Like, North London is the absolute best for charity shops. It's wild. I think it's because there's lots of like RT types living around here. And then they get old and they die and all their books end up in the charity shop. So it's great for me. But honestly, yeah, I can't complain. It's amazing.
Well, RIP to those people.
But thanks to them as well.
so if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, we'll be reviewing the crime thriller Reptile, tech bro comedy Blackberry, and revisiting the Dirties on Film Club. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Hannah Strong and Elena Lazic. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.